A picture can carry a person. They say that a picture is worth a thousand words, but in fact, it's worth a whole lot less and a whole lot more than that, all at the same time somehow. Because whether you exceed that word limit or whether you come up just shy, there's still a whole lot more that a picture can do that a word simply can't. Many years ago, I was in Amsterdam, and one of the things that I wanted to do most while I was there was to go and see the Vincent van Gogh Museum. That's where he's from, and that's where they have the museum, and they have a tremendous collection there of his paintings. And I thought, going in, that it would be really, really cool to go and see in person some of those world-famous pictures that we've all seen out and about in the world in prints. But it turned out to be a much more obscure painting of his, one that I had never seen before that grabbed my attention. It was a portrait of several workers out in a wheat field, harvesting the wheat. There were two or three of these workers, and they each had sickles in their hands, and it looked as though they had been working at it for a while, because there was a bit of a clearing in the foreground, and a few bales of hay were gathered and tied together. But then there was a whole lot of work left to do as well. There was still a large field in the background that was unharvested and swaying in the breeze. And of course, Vincent van Gogh had painted those sheaves of wheat in a way that only Vincent van Gogh would. And the figures doing the harvesting as well were painted in such a way that made you think that these weren't meant to be any people in particular. And the whole thing just grabbed me somehow. Because it seemed to me that wheat wasn't just meant to be that wheat, and those people weren't just meant to be depicted as those particular people, but that this picture was saying something else somehow. And I couldn't quite come to a final conclusion about what it was. There was no narrative from Van Gogh that came with that picture that could settle the matter, and so it became a picture that has nagged at me and forced me to attend to it for many, many years. I bought a print of that picture at the museum, and I still keep it in my home office to this day. And I think that when I first saw it, that my mind was drawn to think of Jesus' words, that we have all been sent out into the world to reap the harvest, that the laborers are few, just as they were in that picture, but the harvest was great. And here they were. Here they were, harvesting away. And that, for me, became what that parable looks like. And look, they're making some progress. But look how much more there is to do. I've wondered at times where I have been in that picture. Am I the harvester? Am I the wheat? Or am I somewhere else? Is there some other interpretation to consider, perhaps? And I've wondered where God is in that picture, because the beauty of the earth as he depicts it and the wind-affected waves of grain suggest a presence that's both hidden but also there. Sometimes, maybe all of the time, but especially in seasons where words have begun to run dry, sometimes we need the picture instead of the words to grab hold of our imaginations, to carry us forward into the silent places of life. And for me, Van Gogh's painting has been one of those pictures. I want to look with you at another one today. Our gospel reading for today presents us the story of a time when Jesus and just three of his disciples went up to the top of a high mountain, it says. Now, high mountains and high places in general tend to be places where you go with some amount of expectancy. In the Bible, altars are built on the tops of hills and mountains. The temple in Jerusalem is built on top of Mount Zion. There's Sinai, and there's Horeb. High places are places where you tend to go expecting to have some sort of encounter with the divine. It's still true today to a greater extent, perhaps, than we're usually willing to name out loud. And so as Jesus and these disciples set out, there's a sense that they set out knowing that they're getting themselves into something here. There's an expectancy here of something. And even though they don't quite know what it is yet here at the beginning of this chapter, there is a suggestion that their eyes are peeled for what's coming. Sort of like walking into an art museum. And what happens immediately afterward, it says, is that he was transfigured before their eyes. His clothes became dazzling white, and there was Moses, and there was Elijah speaking with him. It's a picture, almost. We don't hear the words. The disciples don't seem to hear the words. There's no explanation below this portrait to tell us anything about what it means. It is presented to us almost like a picture. Here it is. Steep on this for a while. And as with most pictures that are worth anything, words tend to fail here. Peter is kind of bumbling for something to say. He offers to make them places to sleep, but is completely ignored. No, this is a picture that's calling out for his attention and for ours as well. It is a spectacle. Words could only diminish what we're being beckoned to see here. You know, words sometimes work that way. They can be our mechanism for dealing with the discomfort of unsettled meaning. If I can put something into words, I can file it away and dismiss it. They can rob the picture of its allure and tame it, so to speak. They can serve at times as the thing that extracts the necessary information that we need so that we can move on beyond the picture. But these disciples have come up to the mountain to encounter something. And those sorts of words almost run counter to their purpose for being there. It's a wrestling match, you see, between the spectacle that calls out for their attention and their silence, and the words that would seek to contain and distill the mystery. It's a picture calling out for a kind of attention, you see. And even the divine voice at the end of this passage is calling out for attention. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. Listen. Attention. No words, but silence. There's a kind of attention being called for here that I want you to notice heading into this season of Lent this year, and in a time when all of the words seem to be running dry anyway. And it's not the attention of words, but one that nags beyond what words can do. I want to call it an attention to the aesthetic, an attention to the images that God implants in our hearts to occupy us in seasons of life when silent attention is what is called for. This sort of attention to the aesthetic is different from attention to words because there are no verbs to parse. No amplification of words that can explain any better. It is a call to be preoccupied with a picture in the silence. This picture of Jesus, holy, worthy of being listened to. We have two ears, you know, two eyes, two nostrils, but only one mouth. That's six inputs to one output. And this attention to the aesthetic asks us to set ourselves back into that kind of proportion. For the disciples, right here on the edge of Jesus' entry into Jerusalem on his way to the cross, this perhaps needs to be a season for taking in a new kind of way and in a different sort of mode. Perhaps that's true for us on the verge of this year's Lent as well. Attention to the aesthetic simply means a call for each of us to increase our capacity to behold. I love that word, behold, because it conveys so much about a kind of attention. To behold a thing is to keep it in your gaze, to wonder at it in silence, to appreciate a depth of meaning in a thing that goes well beyond the way we normally pay attention to things. And if we can come to appreciate that this beholding is a call to a different kind and a deeper level of attention, well, then there's something else that's important that needs to be said about all of this seeing language that we're reading about today. The seeing, you see, isn't really about what we do with our eyes, but about what we do with our hearts and with our attention. This call to behold is a call to attend to something. But what stands to happen to us when we attend to something in this way? This is where I want to turn today to Paul's letters that we read from his second letter to the Corinthians in chapter 4, because Paul is talking here about sight. Just as the passage from Mark chapter 9 is talking about sight, and he's talking about sight here in terms of a kind of faith language, in terms of a kind of attention. As he articulated in this passage, faith is all about sight. It's about beholding certain kinds of images and attending to them. In verse 4, what needs to be seen is the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. And the point is that faith is a kind of attention akin to sight. If we won't open our eyes, then we won't be able to take in what we need to be taking in. God is calling for this kind of attention. It's an attention that has a redeeming kind of promise attached to it. There's something here that we all need to see, that we all need to take in, but doing so requires the faculty of sight. The faculty of faith is what he really means. When we open our eyes and attend, he says, a couple of verses later, we allow those rays of light in where they can do what they're sent to do. But none of this happens without the spectacle, you see, without the call for our attention and our silence. It's when you and I are made ready to receive, ready to behold in this way, that God can do a real heart work in us. That's the work that gets done before the response and in the midst of the response, and that enables the true response. But it's a work that calls out for our attention first. Both Paul and this transfiguration passage in Mark present to us not just any images, but images of Jesus in particular. For Paul, it is the light of the glory, the face of Christ. In Mark, it is this mysterious transformation and this holy association. What are the images that preoccupy you and that draw your imagination closer to God? What are the images that nag you about where you are and about where God is, that both affirm your place but also call you beyond it? That wheat field with those workers, for me, it somehow reminds me that I have a place, that God's Holy Spirit winds are preparing the ground, blessing and paving the way, but that there's also still a lot of work to be done. And likewise, this image of Christ transfigured that you and I are being confronted with today, it too reminds me that I have a place. In fact, it's tremendously affirming of a place for you and me, because Peter can witness and miss the point and fumble with how to respond, and yet he's still called to attention, called to listen. You know, with all that's swirling around us, with all the things that are calling out for our attention, with all of our exhausted vocabularies that no longer do justice to the feelings that we're carrying, I count it a grace to be called into a season of silent listening. With all that we've been expending of ourselves in this past year, what a grace to be called into receiving for a while. Not indefinitely. The receiving is meant to rejuvenate, meant to restore and fill, and sent us back out into the field again. But people of God, this coming week, we begin a holy season of Lent, and I invite you to make this one count. Let this be a time to receive. Let this be a time to be filled and renewed, to take in what God is calling us to see. Spiritually weary people need to be renewed and inspired every now and again. Every now and again, we need to learn again what it is to receive from God, so that we have something to offer when it's asked to us. And all of God's people said, Amen.